Would you please arise for the word as it's read from John 13? If you're looking at your bulletin, you realize there's like a gazillion passages listed there. That's what you read through this week. And again, it's really hard. I'm finding the Gospels to be the most difficult place to figure out which piece to read. There's so much in there. So I'm going to read just this passage out of John 13, but I'm going to be kind of all over our chapter today. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he had come from God and was going back to God, he rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, he tied it around his waist, and he poured water into a basin, and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel that was wrapped around him. And he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" And Jesus answered him, "What I am doing you do not now understand, but afterward you'll understand." And Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." And Jesus answered, "If I do not wash you, you have no share with me." And Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not only my feet, but also my hands and my head." And Jesus said to him, "The one who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet. But he is completely clean, and you are clean, but not every one of you." For he knew who was to betray him. And that is why he said, "Not all of you are clean." And when he had washed their feet and put his outer garments and resumed his place, he said to them, "Do you understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am." This is the word of the Lord. In 1972, just a few years before I was born, Judith Viorst wrote a children's book that was unlike all the other children's books. She wrote a book that wasn't a magical fairy tale. It didn't have a happy ending. It was a very realistic book about life. Didn't have a bunch of little animals who are cute and cuddly and somehow bring together all their minds and accomplish the impossible. It was about a little boy named Alexander. And Alexander had a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. If you remember that story, if you remember reading it, you go through the book and you say, yeah, that's a bad day. Alexander's bad day begins as he wakes up in the morning, having gone to bed the night before with bubblegum in his mouth, and he wakes up with bubblegum in his hair. And he steps out of bed and he trips on the skateboard that's in front of him, and he goes into the bathroom. And he's got a sweater, and he trips, and he drops the sweater into the sink that happens to have the water already running. And as he goes downstairs, he sits down at the table, and his brothers both find toys in their cereal boxes. And Alexander just finds cereal. It's the start of a bad day for Alexander, all just in the few short minutes of getting up. And as the day goes on, Alexander finds that life doesn't get any better for him. He continues to progress through life, and he goes shopping with his mom, and his older brothers get really fancy tennis shoes that have neat, colorful stripes. And Alexander just gets white ones because they're out of his size in the colorful ones. At school, he doesn't understand why the teacher can't understand and see his drawing of the invisible cow. Why he's told to go back and do it again. He goes home, and on his way home, his brother pushes him into a mud puddle. and he gets in trouble because he's dirty. His best friend tells him that, you're no longer my best friend. I have two other best friends. You're my third best friend. It just kind of goes downhill through the night and through the day and until eventually Alexander gets to the end of his day and he says, I just want to go to Australia because they don't have bad days there. And then the story ends. Right? We laugh and we chuckle because we know that the story's true. Right? We've all had days like that, and we know that that story is way more like reality than any of the other stories that we read, though they're fun to read, those other ones, the fairy tales and the prince and the Prince Charming and the princess who always has the guy who comes and rescues her. Right? We love to read those stories, but we know they're not true. Life isn't always that way. There are terrible, horrible, no good, very bad days. And as bad as Alexander's story is, and as bad as your worst horrible day, this set of reading, this chapter that we went through, really is the greatest, worst, most terrible day in history. Your day can't get much worse than Jesus' day. Jesus will ultimately be betrayed. He's falsely accused. He suffers injustice. He endures extreme physical pain, horrendous emotional taunts, and then he dies. All in his 24-hour really bad day. And yet Jesus did it. And he walked through it, and he walked through it because of some things he knew. And I want to talk about those things that he knew, but not until we understand just how bad this day was. So let's start out looking at Jesus' bad day. Unlike Alexander, who became the third best friend to his friends, he felt betrayed, but he was only betrayed by still being welcomed in. Jesus was completely betrayed. Starts off with Judas. Satan entered into Judas Iscariot, who was a number of the 12. And he went away and conferred with the chief priests and the officers about how he might betray Jesus. And as the story goes on, it culminates in Judas actually walking and leading the Jewish authorities out to Gethsemane. And Jesus asks him the question, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss? And Jesus comes up and gives him a kiss. The answer is yes, I would betray you. I would betray you. And then the other disciples who are all around, who just a few hours before had been sitting at a table and said, we'll never betray you. As Jesus is arrested, they all run and they flee. No one stays with Jesus. No one. He's alone in his time of need, but he had been alone most of the night. His friends couldn't even sit and pray with him. They kept falling asleep. And if that isn't enough, Peter follows to where Jesus is taken into Annas and Caiaphas' house. And three separate times, he denies that he even knows Jesus. And Jesus knows exactly what's happening. Because while Peter is speaking and while the rooster is crowing, Luke records this little detail. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. He knows that he's in the process of being betrayed. He's just been betrayed three times. Abandoned by his friends, denied even being known by them. And Jesus, here he is, all alone in the world, betrayed by everybody who loved him, by everybody he loved, not a person to stand beside him. It's a terrible day. That's followed up by false accusations in the courts of Israel. He's brought before the religious authorities, and in the courts of Israel, they falsely accuse him of all sorts of things. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. but they didn't find any, though many false witnesses came forward. One after another, people are bringing false accusations against him, and he just remains silent. He just lets all of that come his direction. He doesn't try to defend himself or defend his character or counter the claims. He just lets the false accusations come. And when the high priest accuses him of blasphemy, Jesus is then forwarded on to Pilate's courtroom. And here again, the false accusations continue to come. They began to accuse him, saying, we found this man subverting the nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar. He claims to be Christ, the king. We know that's false. Jesus had actually said, give to Caesar what's Caesar's, and to God what's God's. He had never told them not to pay taxes. False accusations, one after another, just keep being piled on by the religious authorities. And then that's the terrible part of the day, the horrible part of the day. And then there's the injustice that actually goes on in the courts of Rome before Pilate. He sits there before Pilate, and Pilate speaks and says, why? What crime has this man committed? I have found in him no grounds for the death penalty. Therefore, I'll just have him punished, and I'll release him. But with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown in prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and he surrendered Jesus to their will. Innocent, yet condemned to death. I'm told that this is one of the worst experiences in life. That it's a horrible experience to be in a courtroom and to know that you're innocent and yet be found guilty. I can only imagine what it's like to be in a courtroom for the court to know that you're innocent and yet find you guilty because it serves a political end of keeping peace and quiet amongst the rest. That really is a terrible, terrible, horrible, no good day. This is followed up by physical suffering unlike anything that we've ever experienced. Even the most difficult, painful hardship that any of us have ever gone through doesn't touch the pain that crucifixion brings. Begins with a beating, with a whip that has fragments of bone or metal in it so that it rips your skin apart across your back. And once they've beaten you like that, they hit you and they spit upon you and they place a crown of thorns upon your head just to kind of mock you, add a little bit more pain. If that part of your head hadn't been hit by the whips, we'll at least make sure there's pain there too. Once you're beaten down and physically feel like you have nothing left and your skin is ripped open across your back, they take a rough cut piece of lumber. Think about a big cedar board, a 6x6, that's 7 feet long. And they throw it upon your back and say, now walk for a mile and carry that as that board grates into those open sores. And when he can no longer do that, They grab somebody else, Simon of Cyrene, and put the thing on him so that Jesus just can kind of barely drag himself to the place where they're actually going to crucify him. And they have him lay down and they pound nails through his wrists and through his ankles. And then they hoist him up on some ropes so that he's now hanging just by this weight. He's just hanging there. They say it's one of the most brutal ways to die. You could hang there for days, using every bit of energy you've got to try and gasp a breath of air, and then dropping back down as the nails rub against your bone, ultimately dying by asphyxiation as you exhausted yourself completely. You can't even push yourself up anymore. On top of that, there's the emotional taunt and the pain that comes. It begins with the Sanhedrin, that first court, that they slap him and say, prophesy to us, who hit you? And you remember, these are men who had seen Christ read their mind and who had confronted the very thoughts that they had. They're now making fun of the prophetic gift that God has given him and mocking it. The soldiers bow down to him and ridicule him and pretend that he's a leader when in fact he's not their king. Mocking. The crowds, as he's hanging there, hurl insults at him as he hangs there, shaking their heads, saying, "So you're going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days? Come down and save yourself if there's anything for you." He can't save himself. "Let him come down now so then we might believe." Just horrendous emotional taunting all the way along the process that culminates in him actually declaring these words, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" I don't know about you, but that sounds like a terrible, horrible, no good, very, very, very bad day. The worst one of history. The worst day that anybody could go through. And yet, Jesus died at the end of all of that willingly for you and me. What did he know that allowed him to go through that horrible day and do it willingly, knowing Peter would deny him 3 times, knowing that he would be betrayed by people who would claim they loved him but who would then deny even knowing him, knowing that there would be injustice? What did he know that allowed him to do this? It should begin in John 13, verse 1. Jesus knew that his time had come, and he loved his own to the end, the passage says. He knew that his time had come for him to leave the world and go to the Father. And having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. Jesus understood the divine timetable. He understood that God was working a plan and that God was about doing something bigger than he was, which is really quite amazing to fathom, because Jesus is the Son of God. Hey, how much bigger do you get than that? But Jesus understood that God, his Father, was about something even bigger than his own divinity. He was about the redemption of creation, drawing humans and people back together. He understood this divine timetable, and so he was willing to go, saying, "Okay, this is the Father's plan. This is what's going on." When Jesus was born, he came knowing his life was going to be given as a ransom. Something powerful in understanding things ahead of time and understanding the kind of work that God is about and understanding what God is trying to do ahead of time. We know that inherently. I mean, think about the cancer patient who understands that they're about to go through chemotherapy and radiation, and they know that it's going to be painful. And they know that it's going to be torturous on their body. And they know that it's going to rip every bit of strength and energy out of them. And yet they go through it. Why? Because they understand the timetable and they know that on the other side something wonderful potentially awaits them. Or consider the mother who's pregnant and suddenly the day dawns. It happens for every mother. I remember the day when it happened for my wife as she neared the end of pregnancy and it was suddenly like, oh no. There's only one way out of this. And it was really painful. And yet, they understand the timetable and know that, yes, this is the way it's going to happen. But on the other side, something awaits. I understand the timetable. Knowing ahead and understanding the work that's about to happen gives us great ability to endure things. Jesus understood what his Father was about. And he knew that the time had come for him to go back to the Father. And he knew that the time had come to show the full extent of his love, sacrificing everything for them, for people. He knew this was part of the mission of God. It was time for him to be glorified, for him to die on a cross, for him to go through death, to be resurrected and ascend back to heaven. And from a human point of view, that meant suffering painful, excruciating suffering in every aspect, in every way we could imagine. But from a divine point of view, it meant glory. It meant salvation. It meant relationship. It meant people could once again be in the presence of God unhindered. And we're tempted to think, like, couldn't Jesus have done it a different way? Couldn't Jesus have just kind of beam me up, Lord? Like, just take me up there in a nice little transporter somehow? That would be a better way. I'd love to be back in your presence. But the passage tells us that having loved his own who were in the world, he showed them the full extent of his love. In that passage I read, you recall that what happens is Jesus takes off his garment and he washes feet and he says, this is about what I'm doing for you. It's all about cleansing. It's all about washing. It's all about making you pure and holy and making you right again and clean. The way to be clean is the sacrifice had to be paid. And you and I couldn't pay the sacrifice. We have tainted blood. But he had perfect blood. He could pay the sacrifice. Everything Jesus underwent that day was about redeeming you and me from our sin, from the corruption and the brokenness that we brought in the world. And Jesus understood the divine timetable enough to know that if he underwent this suffering, then we could be restored. If he underwent this timetable, then we would be able to enter into God's plans. Second thing Jesus understood is he knew that all things were under his authority. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power. Romans says it this way, God has put all things in subjection under his feet. Ephesians says, and he put all things under his feet and gave him as head over all things for the church. And everything was under his authority and under his power. This wasn't injustice that he was undergoing. It's injustice from our perspective. But it was willing sacrifice from Jesus. Right? Jesus knew that these guys, Pilate and Herod and all of those folks, they didn't have any power over him. He even tells them that. He says, you would have no authority over me unless it were given you from above. He understands who's in control. It's not the worldly powers. It's God the Father, Christ the Son, the Holy Spirit. They're the ones in control. And he understood that. To know that though you may do that, vindication awaits me. Vindication awaits me. Nothing is going to get it so that I lose what God plans to give. He understood that the power of God was superintending this in such a way that on the other side, Satan would be crushed. Every spiritual power and authority would be trampled down and put on display as having lost. Even death itself would be reversed and overcome. Life was going to triumph because all things had been put under the authority of the Father and the Son. Jesus wasn't powerless. He was a willing sacrifice. Maybe that's why he says through Paul, what can separate us from the love of Christ? Can tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword, can that separate us? No. For its sake, we're being killed all day long. We're regarded as sheep to be slaughtered. No, in all these things, we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. Jesus had that perspective. He knew that reality. He knew that nothing could separate him from the Father, even this pain and suffering. The third thing that Jesus understood is that he came from the Father and he was going back to the Father. He knew who he was. He understood his identity. He understood what God was about. Jesus knew where he belonged, where he came from, where he was going. And his identity, understanding where he belonged, allowed him to pursue and live through a hardship that none of us could live through. His identity allowed him to pursue a course that ultimately cost him everything, because he knew on the other side he would gain everything. So it was this reality of Jesus understanding God's timing and God's authority and God's identity that had been granted to him that allowed him to live through a day that was the worst of all history. And the same can be true for you and I. See, when we remember, when we reflect on the love of God that he has for us as displayed in the life of Christ and the sacrifice that Christ lived, and we come to understand how deep that love is, that nothing stood in the way of the Father giving the Son, nothing stood in the way of the Son willingly giving himself for you and I. When we understand that, then we will face hardships in an entirely different way. It's not punishment. It's not God trying to make our life a living hell for us. It's not God trying to do difficult things to us. It's the reality that God is actually shaping and forming us to be like Christ. That all the things that come our way are coming from his providential hand, the Catechism says. And it's something he's using not to make life difficult for the purpose of making it difficult. It's something he's using to make us conformed, to look like Jesus. And so we'll remember that, hey, this painful time, it's but a short time, and it will pass. And on the other side, I will be more glorious and more radiant and more spotless than I was when I started. When we understand that God's in control and that hardship comes our way as his gift, we'll understand that he also has the resources by which to strengthen us. We can rely on him. And we can remember that there will be victory on the other side, not just tears. When we understand that God granted him authority, and he's granted us authority. As Jesus says, all authority has been given to me, and I tell you, go. He's granting his authority to us. Then we'll remember, we're not beggars. We're not people just barely making it through the difficult times. We're victors. We're conquerors. We're rulers. We're children of the Almighty King. And when we remember that, we'll remember that though all the gates of hell try and push against us, they will not stand. When we understand that this world isn't our home, but that we belong to a different world, a world that will be recreated. It'll be physical and it'll be tangible and it'll be this world again, but it'll be this world better. And when we understand that we belong to the Father and not to this lower broken world, and when we realize that we're headed to a city whose streets are paved with gold, all the suffering that we undergo in this world will seem like just a small phase in the eyes of eternity. And it's that kind of knowledge of remembering where we came from, what God's doing, and who we are that will allow us to be patient until the coming of the Lord. To see how the farmer waits for the precious fruits of the earth, we'll be patient about it until we receive and see the late rains and the early rains, and we'll be patient. We'll establish our hearts until the coming of the Lord is at hand, knowing that all these little things are but momentary trials that will pass away. So, people of God, the next time you face a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, think back on Jesus' day and draw your strength from the things that he knew. because they're the same things that the Father wants you to draw your strength from. You are His, and He's still in control, and He has a plan that He's working out for you, for your good. And all God's people said. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for your grace. Thank you that you extend it to us in immeasurably more ways than we can imagine, even through a little children's story that helps us to remember and point to Christ. So, Heavenly Father, as we come to the table, nourish us, strengthen our faith where it's weak, where we're in hardship, give us hope, because we see the reality of Christ before us. We ask all this in your Son's name. Amen.